Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the revelation that the Mexican government used sophisticated spyware to neutralize the work of a team of international investigators the Mexican government was forced to accept to solve the case of the missing 43 students whose disappearance in 2014 roiled the nation. Laura Carlson, the director of the Mexico-based Americas program of the Center for International Policy, joins us to discuss how the cyber weapon Pegasus, which can only be sold to governments on the condition it is used against terrorists and criminals, was used to stymie an investigation into one of Mexico's most gruesome human rights atrocities, which the Peña Nieto PRI government clearly does not want solved. Then we'll look into who Donald Trump Jr., Jared Kushner, and Paul Manafort were meeting with in Trump Tower shortly after Trump became the Republican candidate for president. Bill Browder, who was the largest foreign investor in Russia until his lawyer, Sergei Magnitsky, was murdered for uncovering government corruption, joins us to discuss who this disgusting, sleazy lawyer the Trump boys met with is. We'll examine the role of Natalia Veselnitskaya, who was not only Putin's point person to go after the Magnitsky Act the Congress passed to punish the murderers of Browder's lawyer, but she defended the Kremlin-connected Russian gangsters who laundered the stolen $230 million of tax money meant for the Russian treasury. Then finally, we'll get an update on the state of the resistance and the Democratic opposition now that Vice President Mike Pence is beginning to raise campaign money as the Republicans gather a war chest to buy the 2018 and 2020 elections with overwhelming resources. The co-founder of Mother Jones, Richard Parker, who teaches economics and public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, joins us to discuss how organized people with small donations can compete against the organized money of the Koch brothers' network. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the disgusting, sleazy lawyer that Donald Trump Jr. and Jared Kushner met with shortly after Trump became the Republican candidate for president. And joining us now from Mexico is Laura Carlson, who is the director of the Mexico-based Americas program at the Center for International Policy. She blogs at americas.org. Welcome to Background Briefing, Laura Carlson.
Thank you very much, Ian.
And let's go back to September 26th of 2014, when 43 students disappeared under very mysterious circumstances. And it became a kind of cause célèbre in Mexico. And there was so much pressure on the government that the government agreed to set up the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, which appointed a five-member team of prominent prosecutors and activists from around the Spanish-speaking world to take over this investigation. And now we're learning that the investigation itself was compromised from day one by, well, we don't know whom, but we're assuming it's some shadowy part of the Mexican government, because these international investigators were, in effect, compromised by a spyware program that was inserted into their telephones. The spyware is known as Pegasus, and it's a cyber weapon that the government of Mexico apparently spent tens of millions of dollars acquiring. Let's begin with, do you know who they got this spyware from?
Yes, we know from the investigation that was carried out by a group of organizations over the past year or so that this spyware is produced by an Israeli company called NSO that's actually majority owned by a U.S. company called Francisco Partners. The company notes that the spyware is only sold to governments, because it's not the kind of thing you would want getting into the wrong hands. It's an extremely powerful instrument. Once it's inside your cell phone, it can take over not only all the information on the cell phone, but also the microphone and the camera. And so it's almost a complete surveillance mechanism on the individuals who are infected with this spyware. What happens is they send an innocent-looking text message, please call me about whatever, there's a number of variations. And once a person clicks on it, the spyware goes into their cellular phone. That's what we know about it.
And it overcomes encrypted messages, and because you mentioned the microphone, the camera, can also mm-hmm. be taken over. So in effect, somebody or some group inside the Mexican government had real-time information throughout this entire investigation of what the investigators were doing, who they were talking to, who was talking to them.
Yes, at least since after the first report came out. This was a long process. The investigators began and issued a number of reports along the way. And after the first report came out, which was quite damning, saying that the government's version of events was physically impossible and that they were having severe difficulties in getting government cooperation with their investigation, it was at that point, apparently, that they began to receive these text messages, according to this latest report. They, of course, did not know that they were being monitored, although they did know that they were encountering increasingly hostile response from the government itself. But this is a major revelation because it's saying this international body of highly respected experts was not only stonewalled during Mexico's most important investigation, but was actually spied on. And because this software is only sold to governments, and there's evidence that the Mexican government bought it, although the Mexican government says there's no hard proof that they're responsible, there's a direct cause of events.
So I mentioned, Laura, that this became a kind of cause célèbre in a country that's beleaguered by the war on drugs that hundreds of thousands of people have died in, and its bodies have been mutilated. Bodies show up all the time. It's a horrible specter. And to some extent, the assumption was that the Mexican people were kind of immune to this horror. But this one really struck a chord, the disappearance of these 43 students and the somewhat fatuous government investigations that have never, ever been credible in terms of little bone fragments and bodies that were burned, but none of it makes any sense. So the mystery remains. Mm-hmm. Why do you think it really did strike a chord?
From the evidence that has come in over the years, as the Mexican government's version has been debunked, and more evidence, much of it thanks to this expert group, has been accumulated, there's very great reason to believe that the Mexican government was involved, not only in the cover-up, but in the crime itself. And we're not talking just about the municipal government, which the Mexican federal government and President Peña Nieto admitted from the beginning was corrupt and probably involved in the crime. But we're also talking about federal forces and considerable evidence that the army that was stationed nearby and that was advised that these shootouts were taking place and that the students were under attack almost from the very beginning had also been involved in a number of ways. There were entire buses that were written out of the official story. There were, there was the famous bonfire that supposedly burned all the students and left no traces, which is part that the group said was utterly and physically impossible. And there were even apparently, and this is one of the things that the experts group came out, attempts to plant false evidence in order to uphold the government's version and try to keep the truth from coming out. The truth still hasn't come out. And the parents are still protesting almost every day. There's still every month protests around the country to commemorate the fact that this did happen and that the government still hasn't given us any answers. It's a case that kind of broke open the complacency of the Mexican public with growing levels of violence and horrible acts of both violence and also impunity within the system itself, and also began to demonstrate the clear complicity and collusion of the government with these incidents involving organized crime and with actually blocking the justice system from functioning.
So the assumption would have to be then, surely, Laura Carlson, that something really dreadful happened here that the government does not want to be revealed, the extent to which they've kind of deflected and distracted and compromised and surveilled this investigation. Is there a consensus in amongst the investigators and the journalists and the independents down in Mexico about who did what and why?
No, not completely. And, of course, the experts don't go beyond what the evidence shows them. However, there are two major reasons that have risen that would explain such unusual efforts the government has gone to block and to cover up in this case, now including, as we now find out, spying on the investigators themselves. One has to do with active participation in the violence and the disappearance of the students that so shocked not just Mexico, but the entire world. You know, we're talking about poor indigenous, for the most part, college students in one of the poorest and most violent parts of Mexico. And the other has to do with complicity or cover-up involving possible drug trafficking routes. This area where the students were disappeared is precisely a critical point for the production and the trafficking of poppy for heroin. And one of the routes that goes straight up mostly to the Chicago market and others of Mexican heroin. So if it were to come out, you know, if it were to be proved that the Mexican government at these high levels was in some way protecting or involved in that, you can imagine what that would mean to the Mexican government.
Well, what we know about the actual shootout where these students had commandeered these buses were surrounded by municipal police officers and they were told, we're going to kill you all. There were Mexican military intelligence officials looking on as these state and federal police officers took these students away and they've never been seen since. And the reasons, as I suggested in my last question, for the students' abduction still remain a mystery. But that would seem to me the most likely explanation, that somehow the military had an agenda in this. I mean, is it the fact that they're military fighting the drug war? And I know at the time when the PAN leader, under pressure from the U.S., decided to enter the war on drugs, there was concern that the military would inevitably be compromised by the narcos.
Yes. In fact, one of the major complaints of this group of experts in their second report, which turned out to be the final one because the federal government refused to renew their permission to be in the country and continue to carry out the investigation, was that they were not allowed to independently interview the army. They were completely blocked from a whole area that they knew could offer very relevant information in solving the mystery of what happened to the students. When the drug war was launched, the rationale was that through the deployment initially of some 45,000 Mexican army troops in the streets on what is essentially a public safety issue, domestic, not something that the armed forces ordinarily get involved in, the justification was that the police forces, both on the municipal and state levels and to some extent on the federal levels as well, were too corrupted from their daily dealings with drug traffickers to take this task on. It was supposed to be temporary, but it turned into a permanent deployment. And we have, in fact, seen a rise in both corruption and complicity with a number of cases that are probably just the tip of the iceberg, and also with human rights violations, particularly extrajudicial executions by the armed forces throughout the course of this drug war. Another one of the individuals that was a victim of the spyware, actually three people belong to a group, a human rights organization, and their lawyers that were in charge of both the Ayotzinapa case and a case called Tlatlaya, where the army was accused of executing more than 20 people. There's differences of opinion about the number, without any kind of attempt to arrest them or to obviously to respect their rights. So these cases were very sensitive for the Mexican government, again, because probably they're just the ones we know about. The chances that this is going on a much broader level are very, very high.
Well, the pre-government, which of course is back in power, they had a tenure as long as the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. And of course, there's a paradox of Institutional Revolutionary Party. It's at the heart of the way that they kind of played the game, where on the one hand, they would recognize Fidel Castro and appear to be friendly to him. But on the other hand, any domestic communist or Marxist or revolutionary ended up dead. Was that what was going on here with these students because they were Marxists?
It's another one of the theories. Mm-hmm. There was no secret that the Mexican government under the PRI was trying to close down these schools called the normal schools that were developed during the revolution and that really were a combination of an education for students who otherwise would probably not have access to education and rural values and revolutionary values. In the rush to bring about what they called the structural reforms and kind of get rid of the revolutionary heritage of the Mexican society, these normal schools were really a problem point for the pre-government. They were students that were very politically active at the time that this happened. They were getting ready to mobilize to commemorate in a large protest the October 2nd massacre of students in 1968. They were pushing back against the education reform that included elements of privatization, as we've seen in other parts of the world. And there were really leaders within the country for some of the protests that were going on against the measures being taken by the Peña Nieto government. So there's also the possibility that they were targeted because of this. And it's something else that the Mexican government really doesn't want to talk about. I wanted to mention just one other thing, that the Merida Initiative has been funding the Mexican drug war, and we've submitted Freedom of Information Act because there's a very high possibility that this $80 million could have received some support from the United States. It goes to show that the problem of what happens when you enter into this militarized drug war with a government in which corruption and even complicity is so high, you end up creating these kinds of contradictions. And now it could be that same effort to build rule of law within Mexico is being turned illegally against opposition.
Well, Laura Carlson, I thank you again for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Laura Carlson, who is the director of the Mexico-based Americas Program of the Center for International Policy. She blogs at americas.org. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the disgusting, sleazy lawyer that Donald Trump Jr. and Jared Kushner met with shortly after Trump became the Republican candidate for president.
Politic need votes. Politic needs your mind. Politic needs human beings. Politic need lies.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Bill Browder, the chief executive and founder of Hermitage Capital Markets. He was the largest foreign investor in Russia until he was suddenly denied entry to the country and declared a threat to national security by the Russian government for exposing corruption. And since his lawyer, Sergei Magnitsky, died in a Russian prison after uncovering a $230 million fraud committed by Russian government officials, Bill has been leading a global campaign to expose the corruption and human human rights abuses endemic in Russia. And as a result of this campaign, the Sergei Magnitsky Rule of Law Accountability Act was signed into U.S. law in 2012, which imposes visa bans and asset freezes on certain officials involved in Magnitsky's death. Welcome to Background Briefing, Bill Browder.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. And of course, just to let our audience know that you may be a capitalist, but you come from American communist royalty.
Well, my grandfather was the head of the American Communist Party in the 1930s and 1940s. And so in my during my teenage rebellion, I decided the best way to rebel from a family of communists was to put on a suit and tie and become a capitalist. And so that's how I ended up becoming a capitalist.
And the reason that we're talking today is that the Magnitsky Act, of course, the one person who took the lead on persecuting Magnitsky and then her law firm worked for the bad guys who laundered the money they stole. I think they stole it from you, didn't they?
Well, so it's a slightly more complicated story, but what happened was that I was expelled from Russia after uncovering corruption, and then the police seized all of our company documents in Moscow, the Russian police, and then those documents were used not to steal our money, because they didn't get any of our money, but they ended up stealing nearly a quarter of $1 billion of taxes that we had paid to the Russian government, and they, through a very complicated scheme, this group of officials and criminals stole this money of taxes from the Russian government, ran off the loot.
So the meeting that took place in Trump Tower on June the 9th of 2016, 2 weeks after Donald Trump got the Republican nomination, of course it was Donald Jr., Jared Kushner, and Paul Manafort, but the person they met with, this Russian lawyer, Natalia Veselitskaya, this is what I find objectionable about it. You couldn't find a more disgusting and sleazy person. So whatever their justification is, are they saying, oh, well, you know, she promised a bunch of dirt on Hillary Clinton. The fact that she met with somebody like that, that with so much blood on their hands, is in itself despicable, isn't it?
Well, so here's the thing. So she was representing people who had been accused by the U.S. government, by the Department of Justice, of being gangsters and money launderers, and that there was no secret about that. And so I don't know whether these guys did their homework or not, but if anybody had typed into the computer the name Natalia Veselnitskaya, what would have come up is not a very clean record. And so, you could either accuse them of not doing their homework, or worse, depending on how that meeting was arranged and what thoughts went into it before it happened.
Well, the whole issue of money laundering looms over Donald Trump. That is, I think, pretty clear on the public record, isn't it?
Well, I don't really have the, my specialty is researching the Russian gangsters and Russian organized crime, and so I don't really have anything more to add on Donald Trump. But what I can say is that this woman, Natalia Veselnitskaya, not only was representing Russian gangsters, or alleged Russian gangsters, I should say, but she was also involved in a huge campaign in Washington, well-financed with millions of dollars, to try to repeal American sanctions against Russian human rights violators like the ones who killed my lawyer. And so she was running around Washington with lobbyists and public relations professionals and lawyers, and she was trying to spread a false story to claim that my lawyer hadn't even been murdered, that he had died of natural causes, that he hadn't exposed corruption, that he was a crook himself. And then she was trying to use that as the basis for withdrawing human rights sanctions against Russia. And she's a very unpleasant character, not a good person at all. And she thought, and I don't know how she got this meeting, she thought that with the change of regime in America, that she could come to the new government, to the new administration, to Donald Trump, who at this point wasn't yet president. He was just the Republican nominee. And she thought if he becomes president, then maybe he can help her out some way.
And the lawyer we're talking about, Natalia Veselnitskaya, wasn't she, could you say that she was a point person, both trying to discredit Magnitsky then and now? where would she fit in the lexicon of murderous thugs that were that seem to have captured modern Russia?
Well, she I wouldn't give her too much personal credit. She was just a hired gun,
right.
But she was representing the interests of very senior Russian government officials in trying to pursue their geopolitical goals in America. And there's no question about that. She was a lawyer who was the consigliere or a lawyer for the family of a man named Pyotr Kotsev. Pyotr Kotsev was a senior Russian government official. He had been the deputy governor of the Moscow region, which is a region the size of France, next to Moscow. And he was intimately connected with all the other characters in the Putin regime, a very wealthy family. And, you know, her job was to do what she was told to do. And if that meant going and lobbying to have the human rights sanctions, the Magnitsky sanctions repealed, that's what she would do. If that meant lying publicly about how Magnitsky died, that's what she would do. And if that meant spending their money, and it probably cost them a lot of money, to get in the door in Trump Towers, then that's what she was supposed to do.
So what is it about Putin's connection then to the Magnitsky case that makes Putin so invested in protecting this group of murderous thugs who stole $230 million of tax money meant for the Russian treasury? Why is he covering it up so zealously? Why does he hate the Magnitsky Act so much? And why, you know, has he, or I don't know whether Putin directly deployed her, but why is this woman over here trying to undo what was passed?
Well, so what you have to understand is that the $230 million that they stole of tax money in connection with our case is just one drop in a huge ocean of theft and fraud that's being committed by people in the Putin regime. Some of the money goes to Putin. A lot of money goes to all the other people. And what these guys do is they commit these crimes. They lock people up. They take people hostage. They torture people. They kill people. And then they keep the money that they have stolen offshore in America and London. They buy properties in the south of France. They send their kids to Swiss boarding schools. And they like to be able to enjoy that money in the West and know that it's safe. And I've created a situation on the back of this terrible tragedy and awful murder of Sergei Magnitsky where their money is no longer safe. Their money can be frozen under the Magnitsky Act and similar types of acts in other countries. Their money can be frozen. And so what this does is it puts the entire business model, the government model of Vladimir Putin's regime in question if none of their money is safe. And so as a result of that, Putin declared, as this thing was moving towards passage in Washington, that it was the single largest foreign policy priority to prevent the Magnitsky Act from happening. And when it did happen, he was so upset that he retaliated by banning the adoption of disabled and sick Russian orphans by American families. And I should point out that the Russians at that time were not allowing the healthy children to be adopted, just the ones with HIV, with Down syndrome, with spinal bifida, et cetera. And effectively, what those children were being taken out of the orphanages, brought to America, nursed back to health, and potentially living a full and productive life. In Russia, if they weren't adopted, they had a huge mortality rate in the orphanages because they weren't being taken care of. And so, effectively, Putin was killing his own orphans in country in order to find some way of looking so crazy that he would be able to protect his corrupt officials. And so we can absolutely, without any question, and there's no debate about this, say that this Magnitsky Act was something that Putin really didn't want. And we can also say that the efforts of Natalia Veselnitskaya running around Washington and New York and other and Brussels at the European Parliament and other places was very much in the interests and on the instruction of Vladimir Putin, whether it's direct or indirect.
Right, and whatever happened in that meeting back in June of 2016 with Donald Jr., Jared Kushner, Manafort, and this lawyer, this Russian lawyer, we don't really know. What they've said so far is pretty thin. One could speculate why they met. But what was your impression of this recent meeting of the two heads of state? It was essentially a gangster summit. I mean, there's no record. The National Security Advisor was not allowed in. The National Security Council specialist on Russia, who speaks Russian, Fiona Hill, was not allowed in. Just two businessmen who've dealt with Putin, Trump and the Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson. To me, the U.S., one, they shouldn't have had this meeting, and two, the U.S. got hosed.
Well, I mean, it certainly played in Russia like Putin won. You know, I mean, and all this stuff comes down to very subtle symbolism. But there was this moment in the meeting where they were supposed to shake hands, and Putin sort of withheld his hand, so Donald Trump had to stick his hand out, and it looked like Donald Trump was making this sort of effort to be accepted by Putin, and they played that image over and over and over and over again in Russia, and it almost doesn't even matter what they discussed in the meeting. All that matters was the imagery that came out of it, and I'm sad to say that at least from the Russian perspective, it made Putin much stronger, made him look like a much more powerful leader. And anything that we do that gives him more power and makes him stronger is really not in anyone's interest.
But it seems like Putin's Achilles heel is how much money him and his cronies, this kleptocracy of Siloviki that he's created, how much they stash abroad and how vulnerable that might be. When apparently Obama found out about the Russian hacking of the elections, he was given a bunch of options, and he didn't really go after Putin. And of course, now, ironically, Donald Trump is blaming the whole Russian hacking on Obama. But my understanding is that what little he did do maybe has something to do with the Panama Papers, which revealed a crony of Putin's, a cellist, in the possession of billions of dollars. And most people say that was just a tip of an iceberg. Also, the meetings that General Flynn had with this Russian ambassador are very suspicious because they happened on the eve of when the administration, Obama administration, decided to sanction Russia further. Whether they were given a tip-off or not, we don't know, to move their money. But Treasury and FinCEN have enormous power, do they not, over these oligarchs and their ill-gotten gains. And this is not a weapon that we've really used. We're not going to use it under Trump because he seems to, if anything, keep making excuses for Putin. But would you have any criticism of or understanding of why Obama's sort of lukewarm slap on the wrist happened as opposed to more robust measures to go after these people and their stolen money?
I was always frustrated with Obama's position on Russia. He was not in any way a tough leader as far as Russia was concerned. We fought tooth and nail at every step of the way to get the Magnitsky Act passed. And in fact, it was only because of the strength of the legislators, the strength of the Senate and Congress, that we were able to overcome what I call the appeasement mentality of President Obama, that we ended up getting the Magnitsky Act passed. And so he didn't do any great favors for us as far as Russia is concerned. You know, with all this glad-handing and backslapping that we're seeing the last couple of days, I don't think that does us any favors either with Trump and Putin. And, you know, we really have a big problem with Russia, and it's not going to go away. Putin is going to do whatever he can get away with, and the only way to stop him from doing bad stuff is to create a firm, hard boundary. We need to contain this man, not appease him, and certainly not slap him on the back.
Well, but the peculiar thing is that the Republican Party, at least most of their representatives, with the exception of maybe of John McCain and Lindsey Graham, most of them seem to be making excuses, and polls indicate that, for Putin. They don't think the Russian thing is, I think it's, you know, as Trump calls it, fake news. And then on the political left, you know, since you're the grandson of the founder of the American Communist Party, people like Oliver Stone also make excuses for Putin and do this long four-hour Valentine. And this is what I simply cannot understand, is this is a guy that murders anybody that threatens him. And nowadays, you know, we should be in solidarity with these young Russian kids who took to the streets only a week or so ago, many of them high school kids. On social media, they all know that the country is taken over by gangsters who are bleeding it dry. But yet, here you've got liberals in the United States defending this guy. And these are the very same liberals who hang out with artists, writers, thinkers, actors, rebels. And these are the very people that Putin jails.
It's very frustrating for me too when I see what's going on, and I see how misinformed much of the American public is about the dangers of Vladimir Putin and Russia. It's very, very frustrating, I wrote a book about it. I wrote a book about what's going on in Russia called Red Notice, where anybody who reads my book understands afterwards what's going on. But sadly, there's 380 million people in America, and not that many people can read my book. But it's definitely a problem, and Putin is winning at the moment.
Yeah, but how do you get the message out without being branded as a hawk who's trying to revive the Cold War? That seems to be the sort of knee-jerk response to anybody that, like me, for example. I get hate mail all the time from the American left for just covering this guy. You know, I mean, it's
well,
possible.
You should probably know that probably 90% of this, what I would call quote hate mail, doesn't even come from real people. That there's a whole troll farms in St. Petersburg and Moldova and places like that, with English-speaking people writing emails and nasty messages to journalists like yourself. And the level of sort of pro-Russian activity out there is not nearly as pervasive as you might think from the quantity of these silly messages that you get, which aren't real.
But what's your answer to the fundamental question? I'm not suggesting that all defenders of Putin make this case, but it is a case that can be made, and it's pretty realpolitik, and that is he's got as many as nuclear weapons as we have, if not a few more. We're talking about 7,000. How do you deal with this phenomenon of, which is unique in geopolitics, the combination of organized crime and national security, the mafia and nuclear weapons?
Well, the way you deal with it, in my opinion, is the same way you dealt with the Russians during the Cold War, which is you contain them. You basically put out very clear boundaries that if they get crossed, they will have trouble. And they don't want trouble any more than we want trouble. It's just that at the moment, we've gotten kind of lazy and kind of complacent after many decades of peace. And we're not in peace anymore. We've got a dangerous adversary out there that needs to be contained. They need to understand that. And if you speak to the military people, they all understand what Russia's all about. It's just the politicians, and it's not a Republican or Democrat thing. It's just, I've seen it. George Bush Jr. Looked into Putin's eyes and saw his soul. Obama had his reset, and now we see this backslapping good old boys with Donald Trump. All these guys all think that they can somehow avoid this confrontation by just appeasing, and it doesn't work.
Yeah, but surely you've got to isolate Putin, but not the Russian people. Is there any way you can drive a wedge between the Siloviki, the gangsters who've taken over? I'm pretty sure that the younger people, the ones that showed up in those demonstrations, they know what's going on. We're talking about, teenagers even. So the young people in that country get it. It seems, but they're organized via social media, but they're not organized politically because Putin's killed off politics in that country. So what do we have to work with so that we don't end up isolating and containing the Russian people as opposed to these gangsters who've captured the government?
Well, it's really straightforward, and this comes right back to the original conversation, which is the Magnitsky Act. You go out and freeze the assets of a small number of really bad people. I mean, you should understand that in Russia, almost all the money has been stolen by a very small number of people who are ruining the country for everybody else. You go out there, freeze their assets, and that puts a stop to everything. And it doesn't create wars, and it also is supported very enthusiastically by the younger generation. They don't like to see these people taking all the country's money and buying yachts and mansions in the south of France. They're perfectly happy if you take all these people's money away. And that's what we should be doing. We should be, back in the days of the Pol Pot regime in Cambodia, the Khmer Rouge didn't go on vacation to Saint-Tropez, but I guarantee you all these Russian gangster government officials do in a big way, and you can single them out very easily.
Well, Bill Browder, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you. Have a great day.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Bill Browder, who's the chief executive and founder of Hermitage Capital Markets. He was the largest foreign investor in Russia until he was suddenly denied entry to the country and declared a threat to national security by the Russian government for exposing corruption. And since his lawyer, Sergei Begnitsky, died in a Russian prison after uncovering a $230 million fraud committed by Russian government officials, Bill has been leading a global campaign to expose the corruption and human rights abuses endemic in Russia. We're going to take a brief station break and back get an update on the state of the resistance and the democratic opposition now that the Republicans are raising overwhelming resources for 2018 and 2020 elections.
From Russia with love, I fly to you. Much wiser since my goodbye to you. I've traveled the world.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Richard Parker, who teaches economics and public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and is a senior fellow at the Shorenstein Center. He is a former managing editor of Ramparts and was a co-founder of Mother Jones magazine and serves on the editorial board of The Nation. And his books include The Myth of the Middle Class and John Kenneth Galbraith, His Life, His Politics, His Economics. Welcome to Background Briefing, Richard Parker.
Good to be back again. Nice to hear your voice.
Well, thank you, Richard. And we were talking with Bill Browder, whose lawyer, Magnitsky, was murdered by the Putin regime. And the lawyer who was attacking the attack dog for Putin, who was attacking Magnitsky and then was defending the crooks who stole $230 million of Russian tax money and laundered it here in the United States in real estate, met with the Trump boys, Junior and Jared and Manafort, back in June. And what I find interesting about trying to get an understanding of how you deal with people like Putin and deal with this new phenomenon in geopolitics, where you have the fusion of organized crime and national security, the mafia and nuclear weapons. Basically, he said that the best tool we have is the Magnitsky Act to go after these people's money. But in the course of the conversation, I know this is a long-winded way to get to the point, given that that Browder was this capitalist whose grandfather founded the American Communist Party, we were both sort of trying to figure out what's happening in this country. Why do most Republicans support Putin, don't believe that he's had anything to do with the elections? And then on the left, you got people like Oliver Stone doing this four-hour Valentine for Putin. What's happening?
Or Stephen Cohen at The Nation, too, sort of defending Russia and Putin.
I mean, why not defend the young kids in Russia whose future's been stolen by these gangsters who took to the streets the other day, high school kids getting their heads cracked, you know? Aren't they the people we should be in solidarity with?
Well, so, yeah, I mean, there are a couple. Yes, of course, is the answer. Absolutely. I think there are two things going on, and they're different for the right and different for the left. Among those people whom I run into on the left do this, it's that they have a story about the national security state in the United States and the concern of the national security state, or the deep state is the more popular, fashionable phrase nowadays, with the absence of an enemy in the post-Cold War era, that ISIS and al-Qaeda represent a certain kind of enemy. And certainly it's expensive to carry on wars against non-state actors, but it's a very specific kind of war that favors specific branches of the military and certain kinds of contractors that are different from the high-tech aerospace Cold War era of missiles and nuclear weapons and the like. And the United States military and its contractors are by no means in any mood to surrender contracts for that kind of high-tech weaponry and the configuration of the military that goes with it, because One, it would mean a decline in the business element, in the business of being a military supplier. And two, there is among that class a deep concern about the rise of China over the coming 20 to 50 years that I think from their point of view is real. Now, we can talk about other things, but I think that's the story that the left tells, which is that the Russia is being demonized, and it's not so much that they're in love with Putin, but that they think that the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And so to the degree they want to dismantle the Pentagon-Langley relationship and its power in the United States, they feel that they can't let a new Cold War emerge by tarring Russia in such a way that it ends up doing what we did with the Soviet Union back in the late 1940s after Roosevelt died. Now, the question of the right, I think, is a different question, and it depends on whom you're talking to. But the attractions of strong leaders have never been a problem for the right. It doesn't require that they simply be equally rightist. And in some sense, Putin can't be seen as a leftist leader. He's an emerging, you know, a rightist leader, a right nationalist leader, who is as identified with the accumulation of personal wealth and personal power through the use of the state as President Trump is, or a long line of Republican figures have been. I don't think that from their point of view, they see Russia as an imminent threat. What they see in their distorted worldview is that there's an American left, an all-powerful, all-seeing American left that has penetrated the schools, penetrated the media, penetrated the public culture, has enslaved intellectually most of the public voices in the U.S., and it's against them that the great Armageddon battle needs to be fought. And in this, a strong leader like Putin is a potential ally for destroying the Democratic Party and this subversive left that they think is behind the Democrats.
Boy, if they only knew.
Chilling. It's chilling in both regards, isn't it?
It's also.
I'm not here to celebrate. Please don't get out a bottle of single malt and boy, this is great.
I tried to crack the joke that if only they knew that the left is not. I mean, there's the myth of the liberal media. I mean, the reality is that America's been captured by the Koch brothers. They're way down the pike. You know, we're arguing over silly stuff. You know, and by the way, the deep state is also what Bannon and this fascist Sebastian Gorka in the White House, they also refer to it too, but for different reasons. But so let's talk about the opposition, Richard Parker. I mean, I'm quite distressed that the resistance, or at least a lot of progressives in this country, still think that they don't have to do anything, just wait around for this guy to get impeached or choke on a cheeseburger. I mean, first of all, if that happens, as unlikely as it is, we're going to end up with Mike Pence, and maybe we should be more concerned about the next president as opposed to this current one. Right. But what's your read on the state of the resistance?
Well, I think it's diffuse, and I think that it's still inchoate to a degree that constantly surprises me. You know, I've been very actively supportive of this group called the Resistance School that's grown up here at Harvard in the past 6 months, and they got an enormous amount of press attention when it launched. And it's just now preparing for what it's calling Semester 2, where it's going to launch a whole new series of lectures and training programs online to try to bring some more coherence, at least in terms of structure and technology, to this burgeoning movement. But at the same time, I mean, these are young people who aren't like the young people of the 1960s. That is, these are people who are leaving college or leaving graduate school with a fairly high level of debt in many cases, and who have been offered jobs in corporate or affluent nonprofit environments, where the temptation to opt for the salary and the debt reduction that goes with it is incredibly powerful. And so they're in many cases quite torn and are having as a consequence, one, difficulty maintaining a consistent level of resistance that is elastic, responsive, and febrile, that does what you do in politics, which is react to moments of opportunity, react to moments of danger, create moments of opportunity, create moments of threat, the kind of perpetual dance that is what you do to do politics. They're not at that level of sort of gritty determination yet, at least the ones I'm seeing. And the same is true, I think, with the outgrowth of the Women's March, and I'm really waiting to see other groups weigh in. The Bernie Sanders group has not been terribly visible. If Barack Obama and Eric Holder are going to take on a lot of the gerrymandering and voter manipulation on the state and local level, which was their stated intention before Obama left office, I've yet to see it. I mean, I sit on a couple of foundation boards and am in constant conversation with lots of a new generation of activists, and of course from the vantage point of the Nation and its editorial board, hear more talk than I see action, and that's alarming to me. Now, why that's so? Well, we could talk about that, but I guess my concern right now is that you're absolutely right. There's a story of demographic determinism that has been played out, that played over and over again, like an old record since 2000. And the essence of it is that we've had a third great wave of migration into the United States over the last 30 years, that something like 20 to 25% of Americans today are either foreign-born or the children of foreign-born, and that historically, to judge from the 19th century, the last previous great wave, many, if not, let's put it this way, more than 60, potentially more than 70% of these voters ought to be voting Democratic for the next generation or two. And so there's a whole story there about, oh, well, we can just sit back and demography will lift us up to a kind of permanent Democratic state. Well, that's not happening. And it's pretty clear why it's not happening. One, we're not producing consistently attractive candidates that turn voters out versus creating potential voters. The demography creates potential voters. Parties and candidates have to turn potential voters into active voters who deliver votes to elect public leaders. And that second part is still a problem. We went through this last battle between Hillary and Trump, and you had 50% of the electorate turn out. There was no huge spike in the electorate. This time, there was no huge spike among the young. There was pretty solid performance by African Americans and a couple of other minority groups, certainly compared to the past. But the demographic argument is like one step in a multi-step dance, and it's by itself not going to carry us to heaven. Now, the other is that the contradiction, or the criminality and or the crudeness of Trump will so alienate a significant number of moderate or marginal voters that we will see a dramatic shift as early as 2018 in the composition of the Congress, perhaps even a majority in the House, and even potentially a majority in the Senate. But you know, you look at the last four off-cycle elections in Montana, in Kansas, in Oklahoma, in Georgia, a couple of other places. And while the Democratic candidate is doing better than previous Democratic candidates have done, the Democrats still aren't winning. And, you know, doing better is not success. I mean, it's politics mm-hmm. like football. Winning, as Vince Lombardi said, is everything. It's not just...
Sure.
Anyway.
There are no second prizes there. No, but in the broader landscape, it's organized money versus organized people. The people aren't organized, but the money's organized. The Koch brothers have seen to that, and it's then should be manifestly clear to everybody that we have a money-driven system and that the Republicans and big money are a more natural fit than the Democrats and big money, because even if they get their money from the same people the Republicans get their money from, they get their votes from other people. So the real challenge, surely, is how do we organize these people and these small donors, which Bernie Sanders showed could be done? Because I don't see how you can keep taking money from the same people that the Republicans take their money from and have different results.
Right. Right. Well, I mean, I think you're saying something very important, which is technology allows the building of large files of small dollar donors. And the question is, how do we add to that pool of small dollar donors? Second, how do we efficiently harvest money from the pool of donors so that the yields from those donors that we do have increase? And then third, and this is oftentimes the most important, how do we get it effectively into races where it will make a difference? I mean, my wife for many years was a senior political consultant within the Democratic Party and focused on electing senators around the country. And oftentimes the problem was not the raising of the money, but adjudicating the decision about where the money would go, whether to this candidate or that candidate, whether to television or direct mail, whether to, you know, one thing or another. We live in an era where so much of the campaigning has been professionalized and monetized, it's rare that you can find candidates who can be successful without the money that allows them to pay for the TV time and the consultants that are thought to be the source of victory. Now, you have exceptions like to that rule, but by and large, I think that's what's true. And my own experience at Mother Jones in raising an extraordinary amount of money for that publication, and my experience in the 1980s raising money for Greenpeace and a number of other groups, was that there are a surprisingly large number of potential donors or supporters out there, and it requires shrewd, tactical, willful outreach to them. And that means recurrent outreach, and that means pushing the edge. You know, I think that we've got a problem, though, with the Internet, because the very frequency with which you can ask for money on the Internet is multiple times what you could do with direct mail or even telemarketing. And it's also led to a diminution of the average size of the donation, so that you now, I don't know about you, but I get 2 to 20 emails a day from this cause or that, but asking for $5 contributions or even $1 contributions. Mm.
And the DNC, every day I get a mail. We're running out of time. But the kids don't have money, but they got energy and ideas. So if you keep asking people for money, you're just wasting your time. Isn't there more?
Well, and the money goes to a small cadre of professionals and to buy an expensive kind of technology that is television advertising.
Right, and which enriches the big monopolies, the media monopolies.
Yeah.
They're the winners.
Yep.
Well, look, we're going to have to pick up another conversation to finish this off. We're running out of time.
Fine. Another time, let's do it.
Let's do it. Thank you
so
much.
I think you're identifying the right element. I think the key now is to find cadres of leadership that understand the scope of the stakes and are willing to, lean into, in Sheryl Sandberg's phrase, lean into making this change happen. I think it's within our grasp. I think that Trump is not a harbinger of the future, but a symptom of the collapse that we're in the midst of, and that we will be able to construct a democratic political future, but it's not going to be handed to us. We're going to have to fight for it.
Well, Richard Parker, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Good to talk with you, Ian. Be well.
Do you too. And again, I've been speaking with Richard Parker, who teaches economics and public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and is a senior fellow at the Shorenstein Center. He's a former managing editor of Ramparts, was a co-founder of Mother Jones magazine, and serves on the editorial board of The Nation. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producers Graham Fitzgibbon and Clemence Penard. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.